All right, good afternoon, everybody. This is Greg Lois. Thank you for joining me today for an interesting look at New Jersey motion practice. Now, this is an important topic in New Jersey and defending New Jersey cases because motions are one of the few ways you can try to get traction in your New Jersey workers' compensation case. These cases often move at a snail's pace. Why? Because nobody seems to be motivated to move them quickly except for, of course, the employer. And because there's changes in our practice, which have, as the state has moved into this fractured virtual environment, things seem to go even slower than ever. So today we're going to talk about motion practice in New Jersey under the workers' compensation law, how you can use it to get your cases moving. Now, this presentation is for instructional purposes only and is not legal advice as to any matter. This presentation also is roughly following Chapter 5 of the handbook that I write with Rick Rubenstein for LexisNexis. This handbook and the handout that I put in today's materials is really written for lawyers and judges, and this presentation is not. So this presentation is really intended for risk professionals. It's really for our clients, although it will follow the majority of what's in my book. And if you're reading along at home, we're in Chapter 5 of this handbook, the Legal Treatise Guide to New Jersey Workers' Compensation. My job in New Jersey is to help you stay in control of the case. I want to help you drive the case to closure. So when I think about any topics, whether they be how does the statute apply, how do the rules apply, I'm always thinking, how do I utilize this to help my client gain leverage in their case? How do I help them use this to create an opportunity to close their matter? And how do I want to close my cases in New Jersey? Typically by way of Section 20. That's a lump sum dismissal. Goodbye. No dreaded reopener. Okay, that's our goal in New Jersey. Lots of things that we're going to go through today are available both on the board, the court's websites, or for me, you can look at the handouts. The rules of court are where a lot of today's motion practice conversation come from. And there's also some rules in the statute as well. And then, of course, there's going to be some that come from case law as well. So I'm going to do my best to describe how this works and how it applies. And I'm going to give as much reference as I need to without making this a punishment. Okay, just give me 1 second. Okay. All right. So, applied to what we're doing here, we're typically going to be using motions to either push or to compel discovery or to create a burden for the claimant. Right? That's our goal. I think of every rule or statute, particularly those that require disclosure or give us a motion opportunity, as creating a burden on the claimant. They need to do something, and we want to push that. Also, I want to move my cases along as fast as I possibly can. And so for that reason, I'm using motions to try to control litigation tempo or pace in this jurisdiction. I am trying to create urgency. When you go to those pretrial conferences, sometimes it feels to me like every party, except for us, is looking for a reason they can adjourn those things and move them off. And I like to draw attention to my case and say, Judge, I filed a motion in this case. I need your attention. You need to address my motion that we filed, okay? Now, this presentation, again, is going to cover first procedural motions, and then we're going to cover motions for med and temp as well, all right? So the common motions that we follow, file, particularly those involving discovery or disclosure issues, and then how do we defend those motions? New Jersey has a rule-based approach to allowing us to file motions. And we are doing this because it follows our next action practice focus, which is just staying on top of cases. All motions have this very specific rule that applies to them. And here's my translation of this rule. Any motion filed or request for the court to do something shall be in the form of a notice of motion. That means they have to look a specific way. I've actually seen motions recently that do not include anything that provide a factual or a legal basis for the relief requested, for the motion itself. I've seen one-page motions filed recently. Those are generally defective because the court cannot grant that motion based simply on the notice of motion. Now, the second part of the rule, which is important, and I've sort of distilled it down here, is that a motion shall be considered uncontested by the court if no oppositional papers are filed within 14 days of the motion. Now, typically, it's going to be respondents filing motions. I mean, we file motions in every case just to get the case going, get some traction, and get some disclosure in them. And we also file what are called 14-day letters. Once 14 days have elapsed and my adversary has not responded, I say, Judge, good news, they didn't respond. Simple situation. You shall grant my motion because there was no opposition to it. Some motions do not allow for a 14-day opposition period. And what I'm talking about there very specifically is any motion to dismiss for lack of prosecution. By rule, those have to be listed for a hearing, and the judge has to allow 30 days to elapse. So even when you file a motion and it's uncontested, it's going to take at least 30 days for that to come before a judge and be approved. So practically speaking, we think that this 14-day motion practice follow-up letter is a best practice. I have to often inform the court of what to do and how to address my motion. In other words, when I follow up with the court and I say, Judge, Your Honor, we filed a motion to compel discovery. There's no opposition. Most judges are going to be very resistant to granting that motion based on that uncontested basis. I'll have to say, Judge, can I show you in the statute where it says you have to grant it? And I'll spend my time educating them. But it is often something that is not observed. It's more observed in the breach than it is honored. So this is something that you have to be aggressive about pushing for. Otherwise, your motions will go nowhere. Only motions to dismiss require 30 days. Every other motion we should be arguing should not get a hearing, and the judge should decide it on the papers. Why? It's cheaper, and it is going to be quicker. What I also see is my adversaries show up in court with lots of excuses. So they don't file opposition to my motion, and instead of filing opposition, they come to court with lots of excuses as to why they were going to file opposition or they have good arguments. And it's up to me to say, Judge, that's cute. They're here in person. They're making oral arguments. The time for that has already passed, and you should grant my motion. Motions, I believe, are strategy when we are using them to assert a jurisdictional defense, right? We're making an argument like, not my employee, case should be dismissed, lack of prosecution. You know, we're making these arguments that if they are agreed to by the court, case is closed, right? So these are really powerful arguments. We also use motions to preclude or limit proofs. I will typically do this to control what documents come into the record. And I will also use motions to set a case up for a Section 20 lump sum dismissal. I love Section 20s. You love Section 20s. We all love Section 20s. Section 20s are great, comma. Most judges are resistant to approving a Section 20 unless there is a jurisdictional issue. So why not raise one by way of motion, right? That's something you can do. Motions are currently filed electronically. Counsel's just got to be familiar with that, on how that is done. All motions have to have three parts. So a one-page motion is generally defective in my observation. The first part is a notice of motion. That's really just saying, hello, everybody, here's what we're asking for. Part number two is typically an attorney certification, which says that, quote, based on information and belief, I should be, here's what I know about this case, Your Honor, and here's why I should get the relief I am seeking, close quote, right? Very simple, straightforward. The typical certification we file is only a few pages, and a lot of that is just jurisdictional facts, asserting the basis for the relief to be granted. And finally, every motion has to have a proposed form of order, and that should be submitted in triplicate. Even though we are submitting it electronically, the order should be submitted in triplicate because the rule requires it to be. So, procedural motions. That's the first broad category of motions. These are not motions for benefits. These are motions seeking that the court either follow its own procedure or provide us some specific relief. Now, the one motion that you may have seen filed by the claimant's attorneys or petitioner's counsel is the motion for default. This is where the respondent has failed to file an answer within 30 days. I've been at this a very long time, several decades, and I've rarely ever seen a motion for default granted. These are generally wake-up notices to the other side. Hey, we're going to default you, respondent, employer. unless you file an answer. So don't get too nervous when you see a motion for default. We can generally vacate any default. Less common is a motion to change venue. We used to see this much more frequently, but in light of now the modern or virtual practice, I rarely see motions to change venue because everybody's appearing via WebEx or Teams or GoToMeeting or however they're appearing in court. And by the way, it's completely scattered from courtroom to courtroom. Different judges are using different meeting technology because the state has not adopted any one specific technology. But any motion for change of venue has to include some valid reason, and simply the petitioner's counsel saying, hey, this courthouse is closer to where I might practice law, that's not a valid reason. Another motion that we commonly file is a motion to consolidate. I think this is a really important motion. Whether you do a motion to consolidate or for joinder, don't really care because they actually result in the same thing, a consolidated docket. This is where the claimant or the petitioner has filed a workers' compensation claim and an applicant attorney has filed a medical provider claim. So typically we'll do a motion to consolidate these together. I like doing that. I think it's a very useful tool to gain control of these cases, particularly where you have a bad actor or petitioner. If you, I'll give you an example of a case where that could happen. The petitioner is going out and seeking treatment on their own. They're doing unauthorized care, and they have a workers' compensation claim. The medical provider then files an application for provider payment separately. You don't want those handled separately. You want those cases handled together at the same time. You want a consolidated action before the same judge. So a motion to consolidate is very important and proper in that context. Next, motion to join. This is, we're asking a necessary party to join the case. Now, you can do this both tactically and strategically. You know, strategically, you're trying to make sure you have all the necessary parties. There might be some concern about who is the correct employer, for example. You can also do this to bring in subsequent carriers as well. It's the responsibility. The only thing that's interesting about this is notice to all the parties. You have to give notice to the party you're seeking to join. So that means you typically have to go outside the electronic filing context to make sure you do that. And then you're going to have to be able to show that to the judge. So we're using personal service methods in order to do a motion to join. That's, again, another reason why I prefer a motion to consolidate versus joinder, but regardless, they lead to the same result. Where there has been successive injuries to the same petitioner and maybe multiple carriers covering that risk, so think about something like a successive occupational exposure or a cumulative repetitive injury case, using a joinder motion is also available. Same things with contractors and subcontractors cases, substantially the same issues as a third-party joinder in my observations. Now, filing the motion for joinder, again, it's going to be a notice of motion, a certification of counsel, and a proposed form of order. Where a claim petition is pending, I resist the medical provider filing their own matter. I want to bring them and join them into the workers' compensation case. A rarely seen motion, which is a little bit ancillary to that, that I want to just chat about quickly, is a motion to preserve the petitioner's credit. There are now so many medical provider claims in this jurisdiction, it's crazy. And when the statute was amended to allow medical provider claims, there was also a protection provision written into the statute, section 33.3, no, I'm sorry, 15-15, which says essentially that the petitioner's credit cannot be destroyed because of the provenance of all these medical provider applications. Where the medical provider doesn't win in the workers' compensation context, they're not allowed to go after the workers' compensation claimant, either their credit or any get a lien or get a judgment against any of their income. And so for that reason, they've written this into the statute that the petitioner's attorney can file a motion to preserve their credit in this context. Again, this is becoming increasingly important in the era of 1 in 5 workers' compensation claims filed this year is a medical provider claim. Now, motions for discovery. These are the most common motions that are filed by respondents' counsel. I am generally filing motions to discovery to compel compliance or to demand more specific discovery and sometimes to demand additional discovery. So Before I move on, I just want to remind everyone about our presentation last month, which was on discovery, right? So these things are sort of matching up. Remember that there are specific discovery opportunities in the New Jersey Workers' Compensation Act. Those include things like interrogatories, which are allowed in some cases by rule. But in any case, you could serve interrogatories and file a motion asking the judge to compel the petitioner to respond to them. Now, oftentimes the judges will not grant that motion, but it is possible for you to do that. So just remember, and then if you don't like the responses you get from petitioner, maybe they're vague, maybe they're evasive, maybe they're impossible to do anything with because they were so unclear. But you could do a subsequent motion saying, I need you to clarify these specific answers, right? That's absolutely allowed under our statute. Now, our statute in New Jersey allows for both required discovery and permitted discovery. So required discovery means it's when the claimant files a certain type of workers' compensation claim. And I'll give you an example. An example would be an occupational exposure claim. They are required, because they filed an occupational exposure claim, to provide to you very specific discovery responses, including answers to form interrogatories, right? So that's great. Another example would be a death claim. In every death claim in New Jersey, the petitioner is required to complete dependency interrogatories by rule, right? So that is required discovery. And another type of discovery could be called permitted discovery. Now, it's not required, but you can ask for that discovery, and you may have to get permission of the court in order to serve those demands and to get any responses. So you can do a motion for this permitted discovery in any case. This really opens up the opportunities to you. Now, the only barrier or boundary to the type of discovery demands you can make is that you have to make all of your discovery demands within 180 days of filing the answer to the workers' compensation claim. That's 6 months. Our practice is to serve every potential discovery demand I could possibly make at the time I file my answer. And I try to file my answers within 24 hours of the matter being referred. And the reason I do that is because 2 years from now, and now this case has taken some twists and turns, and now I want some specific discovery, and I want to say, look, I needed answers to interrogatory responses about pre-existing conditions. And the petitioner says, you never served those on me within 180 days, so you're out of luck. I want to take that potential off the table. And so I will serve them with every discovery demand or device that is available to me under the statute, even if I don't follow up on, even if I don't pursue the answers to those discovery, just because in case later on I'm going to need it. That's something that's really important. I'll tell you another story, or not a story, but another scenario. I have a lot of cases here where I am doing, like somebody else started defending the case, and then the client pulled the case from them and sent it over to me. And it frustrates me to no end that they're sending me the case 2 years after the answer was filed and discovery was never served on my opposing counsel. And now I'm trying to defend a case where I'm really behind the eight ball in that regard. Okay, some discovery is available without motion, right? You can find out a lot of interesting facts without using a motion. So think about all the information that is contained in the necessary pleadings, including biographical information, Medicare status, et cetera. All of that stuff, you don't need a motion to obtain it. Same thing with the exchange of medical records. You can serve medical release authorization on opposing counsel, and they're supposed to provide you with all records of medical care within their possession. And the same things with releases and benefit and payment information. Those types of disclosure or discovery devices are typically exchanged without any motion being done. Now, some matters, because they're special, you get special required discovery from the adversary without the need to file a motion. So examples, reopeners, okay, also called application or review of modification of prior award, you get, the claimant has to provide you with answers to form reopener interrogatories. Same thing with dependency claims and occupational disease claims. The time to serve interrogatories, the petitioner has to serve interrogatories on us within 30 days of us filing an answer. The respondent has to serve interrogatories within 15 days of filing our own answer. Strategically though, I always serve all my discovery requests at the time of filing my answer. Any non-required discovery that is not provided by consent is going to require a motion. So for example, in medical provider claims that I defend, I always serve interrogatories in those cases. I need more information that's contained in just the pleadings. And so for that reason, I'm always serving additional discovery. And then because it's not specifically allowed under the statute, most judges are requiring me to file a motion to obtain it. Now, under the rules, or under the theory of workers' compensation, these proceedings are supposed to be quick and kind of dirty, right? That's the idea. This is an alternative to going to big boy court, Superior Court in New Jersey, or civil court. It was supposed to be quick and fast justice. Does anybody defending or handling a New Jersey workers' compensation case feel like these things move quickly or expeditiously? Because they do not, right? So unfortunately, that is the reason why you get such limited discovery in these cases, because these cases are supposed to move quickly and be cheap to defend and cheap to bring. The truth is they move quite slowly, and so discovery is really not the reason for that. But all right, let's move on a little bit to interrogatories. And before I do that, let me just remind everyone, there is a question panel. This is totally live. This makes it so much more fun if you ask me questions while I'm doing this presentation. So please ask me as many questions as you can. It makes this really much more fun. All right. Interrogatories. You can seek interrogatories, and in some cases you do not have to file a specific motion to obtain them. My advice is always serve your interrogatories in your cases if you can. Same thing with depositions. Depositions can be permitted upon motion and for an establishment of a good cause, but let's be truthful, they are rarely going to be granted in this jurisdiction. We would need to prove something like the unavailability of a witness or some really extreme circumstances for the court to allow an out-of-court deposition. So when a party fails to respond to a valid discovery request, we can make a motion to either dismiss the claim for lack of prosecution, or if we fail to respond, they can try to suppress our defenses. Now, I've been at this for several decades, and I've never had my defenses suppressed for failing to respond to a specific discovery, but just be mindful that they can move or to dismiss. Where they fail to respond, and particularly after we've compelled them, you should move to dismiss their case for lack of prosecution. That's an important moment for us to do. If we do not move to compel discovery, we may be waiving our right to that discovery. And again, this is one of the frustrations I get when I take over a case that someone else has been handling, and they either didn't serve discovery or they never moved to compel the discovery that was not provided to them. Now I have to defend this case that's been reassigned to me by my client, and I'm like, I got bad news for you guys. We're really trying to litigate from behind an eight ball here because there were no timely pursuit. So again, you can file that motion, but it's going to be very difficult to prove. All right. Another motion. To preserve the testimony of the petitioner, there is very limited circumstances where the judges will allow you to take a deposition. And if the petitioner's health is in such a poor state that they may pass away or die before the trial or eventual trial, the judge will allow a deposition. But again, there needs to be a doctor's note saying that the claimant is going to be unavailable to testify due to a medical concern. So very rare. But you can file for that motion. Another procedural motion that can be filed is that for the commutation of an award. Now, I would love to file for commutation in every case, right? Because that would accelerate our payments. That would, we could pay these workers' compensation cases out in a lump sum all at once. Unfortunately, commutation is very limited. Commutation is defined as the immediate payment of the unaccrued balance of a claimant's permanent partial disability award. However, the claimant has to bring a request for commutation, and they have to prove that they're doing it for a very specific reason, that it's in their best interest, and that if they do not have this commutation, for example, they're going to suffer a greater harm. Now, I have seen motions for commutation for things like, you're going to pay us out $100,000 over 5 years. We'd like the $100,000 now because the claimant's going to start a new business. I've never seen a judge grant a motion like that. I've seen judges say, well, I'll give you $20,000 out of the $100,000, but I'm not going to commute the whole award, even if you want to. So strategically, just know these can be filed by petitioners. They will rarely be granted. Another type of procedural motion is that for recusal of a judge. We're saying essentially, this judge should not sit on this case. And there are very specific reasons when the court should recuse itself, like it has an interest in the case, or the judge previously represented a party in the case. Generally speaking, I would leave this up to your defense counsel to determine when the judge should be recused from the case, because there are really, the circumstances are really a fiduciary interest, a familial interest, or some knowledge of the case which would interfere with the judge's ability to be an impartial justice in that matter. I've had a lot of clients say, Greg, can you move to recuse this judge? They don't seem to like employers in the state of New Jersey. And I'm like, that's not valid grounds. Sorry to break your heart. All right, motion to dismiss for lack of prosecution. This is one of the most common motions I file. It's because I'm just as frustrated as you are that I cannot get traction in my matters. I can't move them forward. I can't push them forward. I try everything. I show up in court. I scream and yell. I talk real fast. I bang my hand on the table, and I can't get the traction I want. I will file motions to dismiss for lack of prosecution, typically when the petitioner is not being responsive to me or reactive, and when we cannot move the case into a closing posture. Some limitations to the motion to dismiss. Please note, a judge cannot dismiss a case unless 30 days have elapsed since the filing of the motion. Even where the petitioner does not oppose it, that 30 days still has to elapse. Where we're arguing that the case should be dismissed, and maybe it's because the petitioner's counsel cannot even locate their own client, typically the judges will dismiss those without prejudice, which means, unfortunately, they can later file a motion to restore, which is the subject of this slide, and all they have to do is show any good reason, any objective reason, why they case should be restored to the active trial calendar. In other words, the dismissal should be vacated. So it's relatively easy, even when you prevail in a motion to dismiss without prejudice, for the petitioner to reinstate the motion. Now, the next couple slides talk about motions to join the uninsured employers fund, which generally speaking, we're not going to have much interaction with. I don't represent uninsured employers. Most of my clients are insured or are self-insured. And so that these motions and this motion practice, which may complicate your case, are actually rarely invoked in my day-to-day practice. So generally when this has happened in my cases, usually it's in a general contractor, subcontractor, and maybe uninsured sub-subcontractor scenario. Please note that the Deputy Attorney General's office has a dedicated attorneys that represent the Uninsured Employers Fund, and they represent the fund vigorously. They really do resist participation and will do everything possible to not be dragged into a workers' comp case. Also, the Uninsured Employers Fund does not pay permanent disability benefits. So where the petitioner does have a permanent residual disability, guess what? They're suing the uninsured employer directly for whatever judgment they win in the workers' compensation context. And this is all done outside of the workers' compensation adjudication system. That trying to collect that judgment is done in the Superior Court. Certain offsets apply, and of course there's certain eligibility to show that the who is actually responsible for these payments, and there are some very specific requirements for pursuing that. Again, I'm going to move through this rather quickly because I do not think that this section of this presentation applies to most people in this audience today. Now, the other type of motion is that the pleadings have, as they have been filed, are insufficient. And I frequently pursue this. And in fact, you'll see when you look at the answers that I file on behalf of my clients, I typically argue that the pleadings, the claim petition, is vague and defective on its face because it either speaks about the injury in broad or vague terms, or it's not specific enough for me to be even able to isolate and investigate what's happening in this alleged claim petition. And you've all seen these claim petitions. You've seen claim petitions where the claimant says, it says, identify a location where employee was injured, and they just write, at work. Identify who the injury was reported to, supervisor. Identify body part, whole body. I mean, that's impossible for me to defend. You're not telling me where it happened. You're not telling me the name of the person you told, right? So I can't even challenge notice. And you're not even telling me specifically what injuries occurred, right? So where there are just general, generic definition, vague, subjective complaints, and a refusal to provide me with any specificity in the pleadings, I will move to set that claim petition aside. And I do this often, by the way, as a way of teeing up particularly nuisance value cases for a Section 20 dismissal. All right, so that covers all of the potential procedural motions that you can file in a New Jersey workers' compensation case. And you're going, wow, that is a lot. And the answer is there's a lot. There's a lot in the statute, and there are a lot of procedural remedies for issues that could be arising in your cases. So lots of opportunity for traction. Now let's move into what we're calling part three of this presentation, which are motions that are seeking benefits from you. And these really are going to fall into two parts, right? The first is that reopener motion, right? That application for review or modification of a formal award. This is the bane of every employer's existence in the state of New Jersey. These are motions saying that my condition has materially worsened since my last payment of compensation, and therefore I'm due for more money. And I hope everybody at home who's watching this or paying attention understands that petitioner's counsel just simply puts a note in their calendar, and they circle the day, and they say, okay, this is when your award gets paid out, and here's how long we have after that award is paid out to reopen your claim. And we're going to reopen that claim, and they'll probably send them a notice or a letter or email that says, hello, it's time to file your reopener. Very frustrating for employers in the state of New Jersey. This reopener procedure is very lax. The courts allow them to reopen anything. It creates this giant long tail for the insurance carriers where I can't understand how you could write in the state, well, you know, roughly one third of your order approving settlement cases are going to be reopened again and just start all over again. Very frustrating circumstances. The petitioner's only limitation on filing that reopener is they have to do it within 2 years of the last payment of compensation. And as you know, they will be very tricky about that. They will ask you, hey, could you send me back to the doctor just once for a need for, I just need to get just some closure. Can I go back to the doctor once? And they will do that because maybe that 2 years has already elapsed. And by you sending them back to the doctor for a one-time need for treatment, you just restarted that time period. No, right? So we want to be mindful about that. The second motion that can be filed is the motion for medical and temporary disability benefits, or as we typically call it, a motion for med and temp. This is one of the most frequently litigated motions in the state, and it's filed where the claimant says that the medical care we provided was inadequate. It did not cure and relieve them, and they need more treatment, or their treatment was inappropriately stopped or terminated, or maybe not provided at all. Circumstances leading up to these motions vary, but usually they're seeking medical care. Now, over the last 5 years, I would say, the number of motions for med and temp has increased dramatically, and I see attorneys who are filing motions for med and temp when something isn't done within a week or 2 weeks. They go to the orthopedist says you need an MRI. If that's not scheduled within 5 business days, they're filing a motion for med and temp, and they're trying to get fees on everything. And these are dangerous motions, because if the petitioner prevails in their motion, the petitioner's attorney gets a fee, not based on how much time or effort they put into filing the motion, but on the value of the medical treatment which is provided to the petitioner. And that value of the medical treatment is not limited in this jurisdiction by something reasonable, like a medical fee schedule. Instead, New Jersey is a usual and customary state. And so I have seen cases in which the petitioner received an award of $80,000 or $90,000, and the petitioner's attorney received a fee of $100,000, more than the award, because of their fees on motions for med and temp. So just be very mindful about this potential danger zone. The purpose of these motions is for the judge to determine what is reasonable and necessary medical care. Our number one strongest argument is to say, judge, We did provide all the treatment that was necessary and reasonable under the statute, and so you should not grant this motion. But the motion is also important because it avoids any issue of post hoc appraisal. So if the petitioner goes out and gets unauthorized care during dependency of their workers' compensation case, we can make the argument that, hey, they went and did that on their own, Judge. I don't care if they said it make them feel better. They didn't ask me to do it, and they didn't file a motion to compel me to provide it. And so for that reason, Judge, I should not be responsible for it. Also, this process avoids unpaid medical bills, which could then later form the basis for medical provider claims against you. And finally, you retain medical control of your case until you lose it. The motion for Med in Temp is one of the few ways you can lose control of the medical aspect of your workers' compensation case defense in New Jersey. So be especially mindful of this. The filing requirement is that on the papers by themselves, the papers have to establish that if everything is true in the papers, the petitioner should win the medical care or lost time benefit that they are seeking. Each hearing point in New Jersey has one assigned supervisory judge whose job it is to review every filed motion for Med in Temp and determine if it meets that jurisdictional requirement. If it does not, you can see the judges will bounce these motions and say, I'm sorry, this does not contain a medical record, doesn't contain a report, there is no specific treatment being sought, and for that reason, I am bouncing this motion. Now, the motion should also contain a detailed statement as to what they are claiming is their lost time. It should contain medical records. How many records? Well, enough to establish that they are entitled to additional care. There has to be something in there that says that. Now, what is a medical record is kind of a fun game for us to explore. I've seen petitioners' counsel who go to one of their IME doctors. I think they probably went for a permanency evaluation, and the IME doctor says, oh, you need more physical therapy. And I'll use that as the basis to file a new motion. And I'll make the argument like, you went there not for care. That wasn't a treatment opportunity. You went there for a permanency evaluation. That's a one-time examination. Judge, you should not give that any weight. You should give that my IME doctor just as much weight. So there's a lot of arguments to be raised. Another argument that I will typically make is, hey, the doctor who made this care recommendation is not qualified to make that care recommendation. Also, things like a referral to another specialist. I'd make the argument that that's not actually a treatment plan. That's a plan to get another opinion. And for that reason, the court should not consider that to be bona fide medical care in and of itself. And that my referral to my independent medical evaluator in response to that motion is the equivalence. So a lot of arguments to be made about this. Translating this down into simple English, there needs to be a detailed account of what is the lost time and a detailed account of, quote, including the report of a physician stating the medical diagnosis and the specific type of diagnostic study, referral to specialist, or treatment being sought. Okay? Now, that's what that says in the statute. I'm sorry, the rule. That's what it says in the rule. It does not say that asking for a second opinion or asking for a need for treat or do-over, none of that stuff is listed, so we're going to argue that it should not be the correct focus of a motion for Med in Temp. If the petitioner gets medical care, but the doctor refuses or does not have time to issue a report yet, they can put that in their certification. Now, defending these cases or defending motions, the first thing I look at is the motion defective on its face. I'll make the argument that, hey, you filed this motion and maybe it says they needs all this medical care, but it's defective or it's moot because we already provided that care and your attorney just didn't know that. Again, second opinions are not correctly the focus of a Med in Temp. You can always defend a motion for Med in Temp with contradictory medical. We typically will use a defense medical examination. And I believe preparation is the best defense for a motion for Med in Temp, particularly where it's brought forward for spurious reasons, like a 5-day delay in scheduling an MRI. That's not, in my opinion, a valid reason to file a motion for Med in Temp. Now, depending on when the motion is filed, our answering period is going to change. If the motion for med intemp is filed at the same time as the claim petition is filed in court, we have 30 days to file an answer. And the reason for that is because we have 30 days to file an answer to a claim petition. So they extend the normal 21-day period to 30 days. In all other cases, it's 21 days for us to file an answer to a motion for med intemp. Now, there's a relatively recent case called Capel versus Township of Randolph, in which a motion for med intemp was filed, and for whatever reason, respondent's attorney did not file a formal opposition to it. And the case apparently got conferenced a couple times, and eventually the judge ordered medical care consistent with the motion, and of course, a lot of fees to petitioner's counsel. The defense counsel said, well, I did make arguments. I made oral arguments, and I presented in court to challenge this. Well, the appellate division came back and said, no, that's not good. You need to do this in writing. You must present your affidavits, certifications, medical reports, not simply attorney letters in opposition. There needs to be something more. Proceedings for these motions should take place within 30 days of the filing of the motion. They are supposed to be treated relatively emergently and time sensitively. And there is a very specific order of proofs that the court has set out, and I'm not going to go through here, but it is the same order of proofs essentially as a regular trial. The causal relationship burden of proof is always on the petitioner, the movement. And that we are always going to push to that and say, judge, they have to prove the necessity and that the treatment they're seeking is curative and would restore function. That's not our burden, it's their burden. There's also some issues regarding temporary disability benefits, particularly in this context of motions for med intemp. Right now, there is no formal thing called partial temporary disability benefits. Now, most of my clients are currently paying partial temporary disability benefits on a voluntary basis. You can, of course, compare the Herb versus Soto case, which is an unpublished decision where the judge did order partial temporary disability benefits. But in my opinion, and reviewing the statute very carefully, I see no basis in the statute for partial temporary disability benefits. And so if that is the focus of a motion for med intemp, that motion for med intemp is invalid and should fail. So just be mindful about that. In motions, there is sometimes an issue where there are multiple carriers who could potentially be liable. Now, in many instances where multiple employers or multiple carriers could be liable, for example, in the case of a joinder or reimbursement, the judge can simply say, well, it's one of the two of you, so I'm going to order one of you to pay this benefit, and the other one, who is not ultimately found to be responsible, can reimburse them or will be reimbursed by them. Okay. And that kind of is a common sense approach that we take usually where there is successive employments or multiple insurance carriers. However, there is case law. And in fact, I'm the person who made the case law. The case is called Calix versus A2Z Universal, which says that when I have raised a jurisdictional issue in my workers' compensation defense, the judge is not allowed, they are disempowered from using that successive employer reimbursement method in these cases. And Calix, my defense in that case was, we are not the correct employer. And then again, in that case, Calix had brought a workers' compensation case against multiple potential employers. After many, many, many proceedings, the judge said, you know what, I'm just going to rule in favor of the claimant. I'm going to grant them these medical benefits they're seeking. I'm going to whack one of these employers, and I am going to let the other employers reimburse them later. And our argument was like, no, he's not our employee. We have a jurisdictional defense. We shouldn't be in this case, and you should decide the jurisdictional issue before you decide the issue of medical treatment. And the appellate division ultimately agreed with us in that position. Medical marijuana can be the subject of a motion for med intemp in New Jersey, and the judge can order us to reimburse the payment for medical marijuana. Due to sort of some political stuff that was going on 15 or 20 years ago, the legislature created a second motion, similar to the motion for med intemp, which is called an emergent motion for medical care. Very rarely granted, very rarely filed, but this motion can be filed by the claimant, And it's where the claimant can show that the delay in their treatment would cause an irreparable harm to them. Literally, they would die if they did not have this treatment immediately. So that requirement is that they need to show that they emergently needed care, and if it was not provided to them, they would suffer a terrible harm. The time to answer was reduced for the respondent from 21 days to only 5 days, and the respondent has to have an independent medical evaluator to contradict the claims of the claimant within 15 days. Proceedings were to take place on an expedited basis, and the entire case would be listed before and resolved within 21 days. And in my experience, very, very few emergent motions were filed. We did have some filed early on, but they tapered off quickly because the courts have been very consistent in saying, hey, this is not an emergent motion unless the person's literally going to die or suffer irreparable harm. That's a very high standard for us to have these very short timelines and very quick return times. And so for that reason, these are relatively rare motions. Okay, I'm hoping this was a good overview of Chapter 5 in the use of motion practice in New Jersey. I still have a whole bunch of people on the line here, so I'm imagining I've got some good questions typed in here that they're waiting to hear the answers to. So, I do see some questions. Great. Excellent. Let me open up my question pane and check this out and see if I can give you some good answers. Okay. Miriam says, thank you for complimenting. She says, Greg, great topic. In a motion filed by petitioner and defense replies with physician reports are, quote, in error with facts. What is the procedure to rectify if this could be later addressed if the case goes to trial? And what if the petitioner signs medical release but does not give permission to specific records and defense does not abide by this rule? Okay, so a couple questions in here. First is, what happens when the petitioner files a motion and defense replies with physician reports that have errors in them? How does that get rectified? Well, typically, you don't have to have the motion decided on the papers. So the fact is, if the petitioner files a motion and defense files a response and includes medical records or determinations that are not correct or based on incorrect information, the case isn't over. Both sides have the opportunity to present witnesses and to cross-examine the other side's witnesses. So in that circumstance, where I think my opposing counsel has presented medical documentation, which is contradictory to the facts, I would say, hey, right, Judge, well, I think we've got to put that person on the stand. I want to question that doctor, and I want to hear from them why they reached the medical conclusions they did. So the next step in that case sounds to me like testimony. The other question you said is, what if the petitioner signs medical releases but does not give permission to specific records and the defense does not abide by this rule? So I've seen that as well, where the petitioners, so every HIPAA release says that you can control certain sensitive information. For example, sexually transmitted disease information, HIV status typically, and sometimes psychiatric records are specifically noted as not the subject of the HIPAA consent. And I've seen petitioners have done that. Honestly, when I get those are a big red flag to me, like, okay, is there something else going on in this case? Is there a history of drug abuse or alcoholism or something else that I need to look into, because it might be a psychosocial factor which is going to impact the recovery time of this petitioner? But I have seen people trying to control what we do with the medical or HIPAA releases. I think in general, defense should be pushing for unrestricted releases and then asking for the petitioner to explain why they should only have a limited release. In general, when you file a workers' compensation claim, federal HIPAA statute does not apply, right? Because in any action in which you've put your own physical circumstances, your health into question and made that a part of the case, HIPAA rules specifically say they do not apply in the workers' compensation context. So we're not talking about the federal HIPAA laws, we're talking about the state laws when we talk about this. I would be looking into why they didn't give us a full release. I think that's an important thing for the defense to explore in that case. All right, I hope that helps you. Miriam, Joanne asked the question, Greg, what is really frustrating is when we prove there is no additional worsening on a reopener and the judge puts an increase on the record. All right, so I'm hoping then in that circumstance, you went through a full trial. And my advice to you would be, let's look at the value of that reopener and the cost of an appeal. I think it is very difficult for the petitioner to demonstrate a material worsening of their condition. And the way I protect against reopener, it's no secret. When the petitioner is putting through the settlement, the original order approving settlement, I make them either testify to or put in their affidavit that their complaints at the time of that settlement are substantially the same as the complaints that they gave to their independent medical evaluator. Where, of course, you know they're puffing up all their complaints and making them huge, and that their medical evaluator is coming up with a very high degree of overall permanent residual disability. And so I use that to insulate myself. It's prophylactic, it's protective, to make sure that later in the case, when they bring that reopener, I'm pointing out, I'm saying, how could you possibly be worse than how your independent medical evaluator found you 2 years ago? They said you could barely get out of bed and you were in so much pain and you couldn't tie your shoes. Like, how could you be worse than that? And so that's how we will protect ourselves against reopener. But I do think they have to be very vigorously defended because they are a runaway train in New Jersey. Interestingly, I practice in New York as well. New York has a reopener statute, section 123 of the New York Workers' Compensation Law, and it allows for a reopener period of 18 years, okay? Compared to New Jersey, 2 years, you're starting to go, well, that's really long. But guess what? It's applied very strictly. The claimant has to really demonstrate significant objective changes, and it's rarely found to have a reopener in New York. It's rarely granted. In New Jersey, the judges are much more amenable to them, much more lenient with them, less strict in the way they apply the statute. So I think you have to be very aggressive and very careful in the way you defend a reopener in the state of New Jersey. They are dangerous. And my opinion is when a case is reopened, we should be positioning for a Section 20 lump sum dismissal, and we should be fighting hard to make sure we get that. All right, those are the questions I have. Before we go, I just want to tell you thank you for joining us today. It's always a pleasure speaking to everybody. Check out some other things. We have an email newsletter that we'd love to put you on, give you up to speed on what's going on. You can always check out. We publish 4 or 5 podcasts a month, depending on the month. And my partner has a podcast. Christian has a great podcast called Third Fridays, which, imagine that, he releases on the third Friday of the month. So check that out if you're looking for some 201 level or higher level discussions about workers' compensation topics in New York and New Jersey. All right, everybody, thanks for joining. I hope you have a great rest of your week, and I'll talk to you soon. Bye.